Motopod, proudly supported by Roadskin, a UK label specializing in protective outerwear for motorcyclists. Modern biker clothing that you can wear all day long and engineered to save your skin. For the road, for life, visit roadskin.co.uk. Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. I'm your host, Jim McDowell, joined by Richard Jowett, going into episode 770, the review of the Mugello GP. Rich, Mugello has come, has gone. It was majestic. It was magical in some respects, boring in other respects. But it seems like the after events of the race have spoiled a lot of what happened in the race.
Yes, to say everything kind of came in a 24-hour period is, well, 48-hour period anyway, is a bit of an understatement, isn't it? So we've got a fair bit of news, or crucial news, to quickly jump into. So yes, it's probably in some respects the news is more exciting to talk about than the race weekend, which is not normally the case, but I think special exception on this one.
Yeah, but before we talk about any of the news from Mugello, is there anything you would like to talk about from Catalonia that you have burning a desire to explain your side, or a tidbit here and there that maybe I didn't quite mention during my one-off show?
Yeah, well, first of all, Jim, thank you for jumping in and doing the solo show. As we discussed pre-recording, my week went a bit sideways last week, so hence why I wasn't on with you. I mean, for me, Barcelona, the races were good, but they weren't like terribly memorable, so I've only got kind of three comments, really. Moto3, David Alonso is just imperious at this point, isn't it? And now I'm just waiting to hear which Moto2 team the champion will be riding for next year, because, I mean, for me, provided he doesn't get injured, he's nailed on for this championship. And we'll talk about that, obviously, in terms of the Mugello race. Moto2, I mean, it was a bit of a crash fest, to be honest, wasn't it? So it turned out to be a bit of an odd top 15, but Bosque Scheria, clearly that and the Pirelli tyre is the combination of choice at the moment, isn't it? And a nightmare for Aldega, which again, we're going to talk about in a moment, but dropping it in the long lap loop, oh dear, that'll haunt him for a while. And then MotoGP, I mean, the weekend, just to sort of recount what you told everybody and everybody knows, was kind of started off with Espargaro, LH that is, announcing his retirement. And I don't know if you picked it up in the show, because I did listen to it briefly, but most of the thought was that he was likely to be just ready to announce that he'd be Aprilia's test rider for, you know, going into the 2027 regs, but it doesn't appear to be the case. Strongly being linked to a testing role at HRC, which is going to surprise a lot of people, including the management at Aprilia, I would imagine, because the captain's jumping off the ship. So that was kind of like a headline for me. Other than that, yeah, it was that kind of weird Bagnaia crash on the last lap in the sprint, and then a mega MotoGP race, you know, the full Grand Prix the following day. So although Bagnaia is inclined to drop it at odd times, he does really kind of, he's resilient, isn't he? Because he bounces back so well. He just puts it behind him and cracks on. So a lot of credit to him for that.
Yep, that is true. Bagnaia does seem to rebound quite well from mistakes that he does make. And it is one of the things that kind of makes this championship interesting this year. But let's look at Mugello, because I think the championship next year may be even more interesting, because we finally got the bombshell news that we were waiting for. We'll start with the fact that Jorge Martin kept his word and said, I will be on a factory bike next year. I think a lot of us thought that it might have been, and then, you know, I think he even said that he wasn't going to be at Pramac. It was going to be a full works bike. I think a lot of us, myself included, thought that Martin was going to slide in next to Bagnaia, Marquez was going to slide over to Pramac, or Marquez was going to stay at Gresini and have a full 2025 motorcycle there. However, that was not the case. Martin has signed a two-year deal to ride for Aprilia. Okay. Then from there, we learn that Marquez was now officially going to go to DG Dallinia and be next to Pecco in the factory Ducati garage. And by the way, we've learned that this kid named Acosta's got a 2-year deal to ride on the orange bikes at KTM and not the red bikes at KTM. And good golly, all that happens in a 24-hour span, Rich. I'm not sure where to start to break this down. I'll let you take a first crack at it.
Well, obviously, we weren't there, unfortunately, because I think most of this, certainly the revelation, I think we can call it, I don't think that's overstating it really. The revelation that happened with Aprilia on Monday, I think it was, when this news broke. Was it Monday or was it Sunday? No, I think it must have been Monday.
It was Monday.
Caught everybody by surprise. So, obviously, the entire MotoGP community, including all of the journalists, stayed on in Mugello because there was a one-day test, although it was largely rained off. So, there was very little running. And I think we have to rewind a little bit here because there's clearly been a lot going on behind the scenes. I mean, we knew going into, well, even several races ago, but certainly going into Mugello, that Yamaha were continuing to pursue Pramac, who kept putting out notices to the effect that they intended to be on Ducatis next year. But they weren't kind of like categorically saying that was going to be the case. And clearly, Marc Marquez has been the linchpin in all of this because the other factor in all of this, of course, Jim, is that I don't think Ducati either want or are capable of producing more than four fully supported GP25s. So if Pramac were going to stick with their deal and have two works bikes, then it didn't look as if Gresini were going to get a works bike or a bang up to date 25 model for Marquez. So he had to go somewhere. Marquez came out very early in the weekend at Mugello and said, I'm not riding for Pramac. I mean, he made that absolutely clear, which I was going to swear, that ticked off people in Pramac no end and caused Ducati an enormous headache at that point. Because from a couple of the other podcasts I've listened to, and I do kind of take on board a lot of what Simon Patterson says because he's well tapped in. Whether you agree with many of his tweets or not, that's besides the point. He's well tapped into what's going on and what's been said. And to all intents and purposes, from what I can gather, the Martin deal was pretty much done by sort of handshake, other than putting ink on paper. And then Marquez throws, this wobbly into the mix, which is I'm not riding in Pramac. And Ducati are not able to commit to putting a GP25 into Gresini. So obviously there was a huge scramble, at which point Martin found out or got the impression that he was about to be thrown under the bus. And he simply went next door to his mate Aleix and went and had a meeting with Massimo Rivola. And within, again, what I heard was that the Aprilia team lawyers, commercial people, worked through the night to draw up a contract because they were more or less ready to sign either Bezzecchi or probably Bastianini. And the Martin deal happened basically overnight, and of course Aprilia announced it first, so they completely pulled the rug out from underneath Ducati. So it's been Machiavellian sort of politics and all sorts of shenanigans going on across that kind of 4 or 5 day period of the Mugello weekend. And as you say, Jim, basically, and as it's officially announced today, that Marc Marquez will be Bagnaia's teammate next year on a 2-year deal again. Everybody's going to run up to 27 basically for the new regs. Martin obviously is at Aprilia. We don't know who his teammate's going to be. Maverick Vignale has bizarrely kind of made some comment about sniffing around HRC. I mean, that would be a disaster of epic proportions if that ever happened, in my opinion. But I strongly suspect he'll stay. But he didn't know that the Martin thing was happening because it happened so quickly, and he found out through social media apparently. So Maverick Vinales is probably not the most happy guy. Again, this has not been made official yet, but Carlo Pernat, who manages a lot of the riders, including Andrea Bastianini, let it slip on a radio interview over the weekend that, or on Monday anyway, that Bastianini will be riding at Tech 3 Gas Gas KTM next year. So that appears to have slotted into place. So the big question mark now is what do Pramac do? Because they haven't got Martin. They're not going to get Bastianini. Aldegar will be a question mark, I would imagine, in terms of where he goes. So do they now take the money from Yamaha and just kind of look forward to the future? Because even though they will have GP25s, if they haven't got, let's say, top riders on them, and I'm not saying that any of these riders are not top riders because they all are, but experienced top riders, then they might just take the view that they're better off, taking a large amount of money from Yamaha to run a works satellite squad. And what does that mean in terms of who's riding for them? We don't know. And obviously then there's Gresini. They've lost Marquez. Probably Alex will stay put, but I don't know. I mean, an interesting debate now is, maybe we can just quickly get into it because I've got some thoughts, who rides for Pramac, assuming it's Yamaha next year, who rides on the VR46s, and who's in the Gresini squad. Thoughts, Jim? There's a lot to unpack there.
Yeah, there's a hell of a lot to unpack there. I think the best way to have it unpacked was I retweeted on my feed on X, at MotoRGV. Is a the classic meme of the one kid drowning in the pool, the mother playing with the other child, and that's Marquez is the little child, Gigi Delinea is the mom, the drowning kid is Pecco, and then in the lower frame it's a shark and it has a diver in it, and the shark is Acosta and the diver is Bastianini.
Yeah.
It's like, wow, we went crazy here in all this time. Personally, this has to be one of the most brilliant rider-led decision-making forces ever. Rossi has pulled off some major coups in rearranging Honda to get to Yamaha, to get to Ducati, to go back to Yamaha. Okay. Not going to deny that Rossi wasn't brilliant at picking what he was doing. But Marc Marquez was dealt, I think, a relatively low hand at the poker table. He might have been holding a couple of pair, and that was about it. And he somehow, cashed in for a royal flush and has moved himself. I guess first I'll say this: Marquez has moved himself to the prime spot on a factory Ducati in Logano Red. Wow. He's now pushed his nearest title rival, Martin, to a team that probably won't be able to mount a serious title challenge, although Aprilia will do well with Martin.
Yeah.
Is it going to be a serious title challenge? I don't think so. He's also undermined strategically the ground that Pecco Bagnaia walks on at Ducati. All of that is some weirdly wild political game, the likes of which we haven't seen in decades. And Marquez comes out of this one absolutely brilliant with the proper word drops at the proper time. I mean, it's just absolutely amazing. On the flip side, you've got KTM saying, look, this man Acosta now goes to ride in orange. Oh, by the way, we're just going to take Bastianini and slide him from one red team to another red team, which I think is great for Bastianini. I think him going to GasGas, being with Hervé Poncharel, I think that he's got the experience. I think he can make that bike work. I think that they have to have a different kind of rider on the KTMs now. Acosta has basically uprooted and severely put his feet under the desk at KTM with just the way that he's ridden the bike so far this year. Miller, Fernandez, Binder have not produced the results that that kid has on that bike, which is amazing. And the way Pit Beyer told it was he chose to stay with us. Okay, let's stop for a second and let's look at the playing field as it laid out. If I'm Acosta, where are you going to go? Does he think he's going to get anything better by being at the KTM factory than being at GasGas? He might get some bits faster, perhaps, right? But I think he gets the best say at which direction the motorcycle is going to be changed over the rest of the course of this year and through testing into next year, which puts him at the top of the heap. Again, here's another masterstroke of a political move that puts Acosta on the top of the heap, leaves everybody chasing him at this point, and forces KTM to up their game to the level of where Ducati actually is. With all of that said, Pramac, I think, has no choice but to take the Yamaha deal. And then we also heard sort of like an awe. I can't remember if this was a tweet or I think it was a tweet from Simon Patterson, maybe. I don't remember, but I know I saw this like on Twitter or X. Was Joe Roberts making the comment, I don't think I'm really going to be at Trackhouse next year because I don't think there's going to be a lot of room for rookies. And like that tweet came out and it was like hours later, Martin's off at Aprilia and all this shakes up. So I don't even know what's going to happen to Joe. I mean, I thought that was a shoe-in at Trackhouse. It still might be a shoe-in at Trackhouse, but I'm wondering if he maybe isn't looking at Pramac or Pramac isn't looking at him.
Well, that would be a question of who Yamaha is looking at, I think, under this particular timeline that we're looking at going forward in terms of what happens and who goes where. It's very hard So no, can I just pick up on a few of the things that you say, Jim? Because I mean, this is being get regurgitated through social media and all the various podcasts, and so I'm not coming up with original thoughts necessarily. I'm certainly repeating a few things that I've heard or read, but they're pertinent and they're interesting. And so the first point is to your take on Aprilia, which they are not a championship winning team at the moment. However, a little bit like Suzuki used to be, they are relative to other people in the paddock, they're relatively underfunded. Now, will Martin coming in draw in a big Spanish sponsor? Because if they can bring in more money, they can do more stuff and they can overcome some of the things that have kind of caused them to drop away. And they've tended to start seasons strong and then fall away as the season has gone on. And that's likely because they just, the people get worn out, the parts get worn out, they can't be replenished quickly enough, yada, yada, yada. So if they've got more money, they can address some of those kind of issues. And whilst they're unlikely to turn that around next year, they might by sort of 26, going into 27, they might. And, Martin, whether you like him or not as a character, and this is pertinent to the Ducati situation, of course, he is bloody fast. I mean, and he will get everything there is to get out of that bike. Of that, I think we can be absolutely sure. So Aprilia's kind of position in the last few years, Martin might actually shine a light on that bike a little bit where Acosta shone a light on the KTM. And it might go to show that actually the riders that they've had have not extracted everything that the bike can give. And he might take it that next step as Acosta is clearly doing with the KTM. Now, I think that this Martin kind of personality thing played a bit of a role in all of this. And whilst Marc Marquez could hardly be considered a daisy in the field, he is quite professional. Whereas Martin is kind of like a bundle of anger, kind of rolled up in a ball of energy. And it's very explosive and good in certain respects, but maybe they just didn't want that in the team. And when Marquez kind of made his position perfectly clear, they just decided to change tack and go in a different direction. Allied to which, of course, Marc Marquez is on a 23 bike at Gresini. And from what I've heard, it's not even like the end of the season 23 bike. It's a few steps beyond that as well. So given where he is in the championship and what he's been doing in the races, he has crashed a few times, but then most of them do. I think Ducati are looking at it and thinking, well, bloody hell, if he was on a really bang up to date 24 bike, people probably wouldn't be seeing which way he went. And that may well prove to be the case over the course of the next couple of years, of course. And then just on the Acosta things, I didn't mention that. You've obviously picked up on the fact that he goes up to the work squad. I mean, he's making them all look pretty average, isn't he, at the moment? I mean, Binder, has the contract and will be his teammate next year, but Acosta is definitely showing that that bike is better than the riders that they've had have been showing it, and that includes Binder, really, who has been the standout performer on that bike. But compared to Acosta, doesn't appear to be anywhere at the moment. Now, not to say he won't turn it around, and I'm sure that he will because he's a quality rider. But Acosta is just on another level at the moment. As to whether Bastianini is going to fit in there, I've got my doubts a little bit, really. But again, time will tell, but Bastianini's big problem is he's jumping on the bike that Acosta's going to vacate, and that's a pretty uncomfortable place to go to, I would think. Particularly given that Bastianini's spectacular at the end of the race, but he's not particularly spectacular any other time. So, don't know. He's only ever ridden the Ducati as well, hasn't he, Bastianini in MotoGP? So it's a big change for him, and it'll either work or it'll be a bit of a disaster. So I hope it's the former, but that KTM is not the easiest bike to ride. It's kind of Honda-ish in its DNA, and it works for some people and it doesn't for others. And you can't really class Acosta in that equation because he's an alien. So the normal rules don't apply to the three or four aliens that exist at any given point in time. I mean, arguably there's only two, or maybe three. I don't know. We can argue that one out another day. But Acosta's definitely an alien as far as I'm concerned, to use the terminology from the sort of 2010s.
Yes, Acosta is the alien. I think Marquez is the other alien. You could argue Martin is the third, and after that, we can argue. If we go back to Martin and Aprilia real quick, my last thought on it is probably the last piece of the puzzle Aprilia was missing was the top tier quality rider that was going to push that bike and push them to make the bike better. The results of which is going to take a little bit of time. But it's an odd position for them to be in by time. By the time Martin can get on the bike at the end of the year, can they actually affect any kind of massive change? If they don't, it's going to be all throughout 2025. they're then going to get to 26, and with all of the massive rule changes that are coming for 2027, is there enough time for them to then build a really good 26 bike and maybe take a championship, or do they sacrifice some of the 26 bike to get the 27 bike competitive? That's a strange place to be.
But Jim, that's why I think it's the Acosta KTM point is pertinent, because it may well be that the Aprilia is a much better bike than their current riders are showing it to be. And that if Martin jumps on it, maybe they don't need to do a big step. Maybe he will just bring more out of the package that they've already got. I think Aprilia's weakness, as you've already said, and we were just talking about, is more of an operational one. And that's more to do with budget than skill or engineering or bike development. I mean, let's be honest, Aprilia have completely led the way, I would argue, certainly in terms of the ground effect aero that's come in. I mean, they
That's
were the
true.
first to have the step sides and stuff and really start to play with that part of the aero. So, I mean, they're very forward thinking, but they are small and they have a very small budget. So if they can sort that bit out, then Martin plus that, you know, if they can bring a big title sponsor on board, because they don't have one. And I don't think they ever have, really, since they came into MotoGP. Certainly not in this latest iteration. I mean, they did back in the 990 era, but, you know, they need a big title sponsor that will throw a big hunk of cash at them. So, and, you know, Martin, imagine the motivation he's going to have to go and beat the Ducatis, having been shunned, I mean,
Snubbed.
certainly twice, and you might argue three times, actually, over his recent history. So he's going to be a man on a mission. And I'm really looking forward to seeing that, actually, because although, again, he's a bit of a divisive character, as many of them are, he is very, very, very fast. So that's always where you want to be as a team,
Yeah.
having one of them on your bike.
Martin is the Lewis Hamilton of MotoGP. Incredibly fast, amazingly talented, yet I can't stand how his attitude is off of the bike and around the team.
Yeah, some of the things he says, they stick in the throat a bit.
You are possibly right about Aprilia. I was looking at it from the fact that can they find a sponsor, a big title sponsor? Are they going to land? I don't know. Can't think of a really large Spanish company besides Repsol or maybe Australia Galissi that would go to Pramac. That's to be seen. Is it only money that's the problem? Possibly. You could be right. Martin may be just enough to push them to the front where they need to be consistently. I just think that they're still a little behind. And if they want to, I think everybody's got a lot of time to try to figure out an engine, a chassis for that engine, and then revamp themselves for no ride height controls or any of that kind of stuff is going to take time and money. Which is going to go against Aprilia developing the 25 bike and the 26 bike. That's how I see it. But either way, where everybody's pieced so far on what we think of as the big three teams, the KTMs, the Ducatis, and the Aprilias, it should be absolutely fascinating to watch what happens next year. I'll leave it there.
Do you want to have a stab at who's going to be on a Pramac Yamaha if that is what comes to pass?
Can I back that up just slightly and maybe flip this on you because I need some time to think. Where does Audiger go on a Ducati? Does he go to Pramac? If Pramac decides against going to Yamaha, would they put Audiger there? Or does Audiger take Marc Marquez's spot in Gresini?
It depends what his contract says about what bike he's entitled to ride, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
We may be completely wrong about the Pramac Yamaha thing, and it might well be the case that Yamaha don't get their wish of a satellite squad, although clearly they're opening the checkbook and trying to entice somebody to do it. I think if a Pramac Yamaha is on the grid next year, I think Aldeguer, because Ducati have to place in summer, I think he goes to VR46, admittedly on a year-old bike. And I think Didier goes to Yamaha because I think Didier would be a good fit for Yamaha because he's a very competent rider. And I think he's a good development rider as well. You saw the way he grew into the Gresini ride just by the skin of his teeth. He retained a place, but he did. I think he would be a good fit there. I don't see Morbidelli wanting to get back on a Yamaha. So what happens to Morbidelli? I think he goes to Gresini and goes on to an older Ducati in order to stay in MotoGP. And for the other Yamaha bike, if it is a Pramac Yamaha, I wouldn't be surprised if Yamaha went shopping in Moto2, and I could certainly see somebody like Sergio Garcia getting the call, because again, he would be good to come up onto a satellite Yamaha in particular. as a Moto2, maybe not champion, maybe. I mean, he's doing pretty well, but he's certainly shown himself to be at the top of the of two or three riders, maybe four in Moto2 this year, excepting that Aldo's already got a deal. I think Garcia, Aguirre, Joe Roberts, he has to be considered for a MotoGP ride, particularly after the weekend he's just had. And possibly even with a bit of a sort of passport aspect to it, maybe even Dixon might be of interest to a Pramac Yamaha because, again, it could work. And he has ridden the Yamaha before, albeit briefly, when he subbed for Dovi, I think it was, a couple of seasons ago. Did a couple of races on the, what was it, the, oh, I forget what the sponsorship name, the old RNF Yamaha before they switched to Aprilia. He rode at Silverstone and a couple of other rounds that year, I think. So that could happen, but I certainly see Garcia as a potential. So I would say Pramac Yamaha, Digia, and Garcia, VR46. I don't see that Bezzecchi has anywhere to go really, and I could see Aldegar slotting in next to him, and then Gresini, Alex Marquez, and maybe a Morbidelli if he wants to stay in MotoGP, because I don't know where else he would go.
I'm going to go with that because I can't argue it. The only thing is like who fills out the Aprilia.
Your question really is track house, isn't it?
Yeah. Raul seems to have figured things out slightly.
Yeah, I could see them keeping Raul and
Maybe Oliveira too, because he has kind of
well,
turned it around a smidge, but not enough.
I think the clock's running out on Miguel, to be honest. I mean, what the hell do I know? I mean, but you know, because he started off strong on, you know, when that was the RNF Aprilia last season, and of course, in what round two, he got torpedoed by Marc Marquez. I mean, the irony of it all, and he hasn't ever really kind of found any form since then because he obviously had a big injury as a result of that crash, which was not his fault. And he's shown a few glimmers in the last couple of races, hasn't he? But whether it's enough to save him, I'm rather doubtful at the moment. And just is it Justin Marks? I think the guy who's in charge at
Yes.
Trackhouse, the team owner. I mean, he gave an interview. I don't know if you caught it, Jim. It was on the Dorna feed, where he was kind of being fairly resolute about the fact that they're not that team doesn't exist to give an American rider a position just because they're an American rider. And that kind of felt as if it was aimed at Joe Roberts a little bit, if I'm honest. But that was before Sunday happened, and
Motivation.
that was a statement kind of well, I'm sure most people know what the result was. So it was a statement win, wasn't it? And certainly puts him back in serious contention for that ride, I would have thought. But who knows? And then the only other one I mentioned is Aguirre, really. And you could certainly see him slotting in place of Nakagami if Aguirre wants to risk potential career suicide by jumping on the Honda at the moment.
Where does Mir go?
He's talking about retiring at the minute.
He's talking about it, but if Trackhouse says, "Hey, we want you," are you not going?
He would definitely go. Yeah.
If Pramac has a Yamaha, I think they go talk to Mir.
Yeah.
Come here. It's a four-cylinder inline. You last time you had a sweet handling bike, you won a world championship. Come here. Other than that, I don't know. I really don't know. It's going to be interesting and fun to see how this plays out as we continue on. I think we've explained as much as we know and as much as
Yeah.
we can
Oh, it's all
speculate
speculation, isn't
about
it?
silly season. Other than the knowns of where people are as far as Marquez and Martin and Bastianini and Acosta, everything else is fluid because contracts are made to be broken.
But again, Jim,
I'll do.
let's just say, but let's not kind of paint over the fact that that Marquez thing over the weekend, that was a bombshell. I mean,
Oh,
nobody, I
yes.
don't think anybody in the paddock saw that one coming. And it happened so fast that, yeah, it just caught everybody out. Although people have been speculating about it, I think most people felt that Mark would get a 25 bike in the Gresini squad, or if he had to go to Pramac, that's what he would do. And he just played an absolute blinder by saying, "I'm not going to Pramac. That is not an option for me." And he really forced Ducati's hand. And you might argue that they panicked or they just made a hard decision, but it all happened so fast. That is kind of like the magic of, you know, when this sort of thing happens. It happens in lots of different sports, not exclusive to MotoGP by any stretch of the imagination. But when it does happen, it's just kind of dynamite, isn't it?
Yeah, I have this vision in my head of Tardozzi and Gigi talking and say, "Hey, look, we're gonna put Martin in the team, right? Yep. Okay, all right. So then we're gonna make Mark go to Pramac, right? And he gets the other 20-25 bike. Yep. That's what we're all in agreement with this. Okay, cool.
And Pramac stays on board under that
And Pramac
scenario.
stays on board, right?
Everybody's happy.
So everybody's happy. I see this as the picture. And then I see Tardassi walking over to Marquez and he dances. Hey, Mark, we're going to get you a 25 bike, but we're going to put you in Pramac. Nope, ain't riding it if it's in Pramac. What? Not doing it. And then you kind of see Tardassi kind of explode because he doesn't know what to do. And then you see Mark running off. He finds Gigi and says, Gigi, I thought we had a deal. And who runs the roost there, bud? And then Gigi goes back to Tardassi and says, well, this is what we're going to do. We're going to put Mark next to Pecco and we don't, we're just jettisoning Martin. Well, we promised him that it doesn't matter. This is what we're doing. And I just kind of watched I would love to have had the sweater cam on Tardazzi
Yeah.
during all this whole sequence because it would be fascinating to see who really runs the show there. I think Gigi runs the show in the team.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Again, help me, the guy who runs Ducati, I want to say I can never get his name right.
I was just trying to think of it myself. No, I came up with Stefano Domenicali, but that's the guy who runs Formula One, isn't it? So that's not right. I'll have
That's all
to
right.
let me dwell on that for a minute. But he always wears
It's
a
fine.
white shirt, didn't he?
Yes.
He used to be the team manager back in the Troy Bayliss and Loris Capirossi days when they first came in as in the 990. Oh, what is his name? Golly, this is ages, ages, age and time of day.
Anyway, I can just imagine him
I'll look him
standing
up.
there. But yeah, that's okay. I just can imagine him looking at Tardazzi and going like, I go with what Gigi says, and that's how it is. And then that's the end of the conversation. And then here we are standing here all bombshelled and shell-shocked over what just happened. And now the scramble is on with it. I mean, I don't think the Acosta thing was really that big of a shock.
No.
What made it sound shocking was that Pit Beyer said, well, he wants to be with us. Time out there, Pit. Where else was the kid going to go?
Well, every single factory would have been,
He was
opening the
not going to go to
checkbook.
Honda.
No.
Career suicide,
Well,
right?
it would have been, but they would have been offering a king's ransom to get
Gobs of
his,
money. Yes. Oh, of course. Anybody else probably would couldn't have afforded the money that Acosta wanted, and so that was just where it was going to stay. The bigger thing is guessing who is going to have the best motorcycle in 2027 because you're going to see another huge round of games going into that 2027 because people are going to there's going to be all these leaks about who's testing what and who looks good and who doesn't. And people are going to be shifting to try to figure out to position themselves to be on what could be the best motorcycle, right? Times like these, I wouldn't bet against Honda not building some kind of 850cc monster motor, and I wouldn't bet against Ducati not doing it either. But then, if you're eliminating and reducing most of the aerodynamics and taking away all the ride heights part of it, you got to throw Honda's name back in there having a shot of pulling themselves out of this hole. I don't, you obviously can plant Yamaha in there for having a really good chassis. So then it's like, well, where does Aprilia fit in all this? And is KTM going to make something? And oh, that's just enough to make my head spin.
Another
Anyway,
point, Jim, because I
yes.
know we've got to crack get onto the actual races, but what we're seeing in Moto2 in particular, and let's pick on poor old Tony Arbolino again. In MotoGP in 2026, a rider that's great on an end of evolution, current generation, 1,000cc wings, ride height devices bike doesn't necessarily make the transition to a new set of regs bike. You can't take it for granted that somebody will just make that transition and still be at the very, very top, and certainly not necessarily straight away. So there's a huge amount of disruption coming with those reg changes because they are very significant changes. And just the other thing, Claudio Domenicali.
Domenico, yes, thank you.
Yeah. Sorry, I forgot as well.
It's okay. Quickly on your thought there of somebody who's great on an end of evolution bike at 1,000 cc's with wings and ride height devices may not be good on a bike. That's a very true statement. I agree with you, Rich, but I will tell you this: the alien-esque guys are going to adapt faster to that than anyone else.
Agreed.
So your Acostas, your Benyayas, your Martins are probably going to adapt quicker to that solution than, say, maybe an Audiger, a DiGiantonio, a Bezzecchi. So Mir, given the opportunity of being plugged onto a 27 bike, may regain his form. You don't know. It's a wild shot, but okay.
We got all that to come.
Third time's a charm. We're going to go to the actual racing now, folks. Again, that was some great news that had come out. It was pretty much, I think everybody was waiting for that, but I didn't think we were going to get all of this. I thought we were going to learn like maybe one person was going to leave, move, or something was going to happen. I mean, Honestly, at the Acosta news having happened at Mugello wasn't that big of a deal. I think we all kind of understood that, and I thought, well, okay,
We knew
that's
that was
it.
coming.
We're going into this 3 weeks, and well, anyway, here we are. Anyway, let's get to Moto3. Let's go to the racing. The first qualifying session for Moto3, it had Baroli, it had Kelso, Piquet, it had Munoz and Epstein. Kelso and Munoz are sort of outliers in that group. I think this is the first or second time Kelso was in that first qualifying session, and Munoz has been in that first qualifying session before, but you're finding out that's a little bit odd. And then you found out that Joel Kelso had signed with MTA team for next year for Moto3 already. So Kelso, who was one of the last signings to get on the Bowie Motorsport bike and one of the last signings for Moto3 to begin with, had taken an opportunity when given it, went to get to the Italian team, to get to MTA, level up. And the way Bowie said it, they were like, well, we said, Joel, we need results from you and you can have a contract. But apparently the results that Joel was getting wasn't good enough for Bowie. It's kind of how I took that, which I thought that was a little shocking. I mean, there's been a little dip in form here, but if you're there, I mean, it also explains kind of why Joel was late to both interviews that I had, because maybe that's where he was really doing the deal, was in COTA. I'm speculating and I have no idea. He could have just been in other commitments that ran late. I have no idea. But for it to be announced this early on, and we're only three races prior from where we were at COTA, I'm just kind of putting two and two together.
I believe, Jim, that he rode for that team in the junior championships as well. So there's some history
Ooh.
there. So maybe they've seen his form and thought, right, we'll have a bit of that. We'll have him back.
Well, it could have been. Could very well could have been. Either way, Ogden, Munoz, Kelso, and Faroli all go to the second one. And Ogden actually only got to where he got because he had a massive tow of like three bikes that towed him across. Again, I think they were saying Moto3 was like 3/10 in the draft. So
Big.
kind of crazy. Big, huge. So we get to the second qualifying session where we learn that Alonso has been 7/10 faster than everybody. Right now, I think Alonso has never been beaten in a practice session to being the number one rider in Moto GP or Moto 3. I think he's like six sessions in a row or something he's topped, and he's done them by huge amounts compared to anybody else of this. Vire would go down at turn one, or sorry, turn 11. I'm sorry. He went down quickly, got remounted, got back up again. Alonso was on pole, followed by Ortola, who had then followed him and then was that a little bit quicker there. But then Alonso just stayed out and stayed cool. So try to set the scene. I guess it didn't do very well. Alonso was out and then Ortola came out right behind him. So those two were, Ortola was like glued to the back of Alonso for the whole, I think they ran like the last five or six laps, just hooked together. And the interesting to me was that Alonso didn't care that Ortola was there. He knew he was close. He didn't care. He put his head down. And after about three laps, Ortola could not run the pace that Alonso could. So then Alonso winds up taking the pole over Ortola. And then you had Rueda, Vire, Holgado, and Lunetta on that front row. So I really thought it was good of Alonso to just say, I don't really care. I'm fast. And if you want to run this pace with me, go ahead. But you're not going to be able to. And it was really interesting because they spent a lot of time following Alonso and Ortola around. You could see, I think it's the third sector. Alonso was brilliant through that sector. He would put a gap on Ortola, and Ortola would get just enough back in the fourth sector to get the long, to get the draft and pull on through. So that was the qualifying session of it. We went to the race. We would find out that Faroli and Esteban had long lap penalties because they had slow riding and were impeding during the practice session. So they were going to have to deal with that during the race. Alonso did get a hole shot. He got followed by Ortola. Forsato was up like five places heading into the first turn. It was in Vire, Rueda, and Munoz, who also had a very good start to get from where he was. Holgado went backwards to 10th. And then Alonso was off the edge of the curbing, I think, at a turn six or something.
Oh, yeah, that was nearly a big one.
Oh, that was a moment. Yeah, he was out of the seat. The bike was all over the place. I thought, whoa, this is all over for our boy Alonso. But he pulled it back in again, and then we get into this the drafting game that was going to start to be played, and Vire would go by for Asato, then they suck on by with Rueda going by Rollstone, and they're sort of all over the place. And we got a red flag for a crash that happened at turn 9. Is it Zarathustra, the other Spanish rider on the KTM?
I think it might be Zaratustra, but
Zarathustra,
I
thank
might be
you.
wrong on that.
I think you're right. Zarathustra falls, and then Farioli went right into him at, I'm not sure where exactly that is. Turn 9, I'm trying to think, like that's down Casanova area, I think, where they're heading back downhill. And it was very reminiscent of the tragedy that happened with the Moto3 rider a few years ago. Rider in front makes a mistake. There's absolutely nowhere to go. You're pinned on the throttle. I was very paranoid that we had another very severe situation, having seen a brief glimpse of the replay and saw from the angle it looked like it had hit, Farioli had hit Zarathustra in the back near the top of the shoulders, collarbone area. Very scared about the neck in that area for that crash. We quickly went to a red flag, which only heightened the intensity of the potential problem that could have happened there. But we did learn that he was conscious. They did put him in an ambulance. It appeared to be moving, and he kind of had like a wave to the crowd, a small thumbs up. They did say that he had some back trauma, which I believe would be the best way to put it. Given the fact that I'm traveling this week, folks, I'm actually not at home. I haven't seen Rich. Is there any more medical news on them?
I think he's been cleared now, so
Great.
no
That's fantastic.
serious injury. We're happy to report because, as you say, Jim, it did look initially very unpleasantly reminiscent of the Jason DePasquier, was it, who got killed
I believe
there
so.
4 or 5 years ago? Just that horrible crash where, they're going so fast. If somebody goes down, it's very hard for the following rider to do anything about it. But no, I think he's pretty well, okay. I mean, I'm sure he's feels as if he's been in a big crash because he has, but yeah, it could have been a heck of a lot worse. Let's just put it that way.
So this now meant that we'd have to restart the race. We would have 11 lap sprint to the finish. They would do the fast restart. So, okay, pit lane opens for 60 seconds. You've got to be out there. You come around on the siding lap. You have your mechanic out there, and then you proceed to a warm-up lap, and we go racing. Vire stalled the Husqvarna at the end of pit road. Luckily, his crew was able to get to him quickly enough to give him a push start. He made it out with about 4 seconds before the pit lane would have closed. He would have been then forced to start at the back of the grid, which would have been a major disaster for Vire. But on the restart, Alonso got the whole shot ahead of Ortola. Rueda had a crash, then Nepa, and then Suzuki was down at turn 10. Vire would race his way to the front with Furusato and Alonso. So again, now we're finally starting to get this group that settles in, because the front four guys, basically front five guys, who were Vire, Furusato, Alonso, Ortola, and Munoz, they had a gap. They had gapped basically everyone. Then it was like Yamanaka. Holgado got a double long lap for the crash incident that happened in turn one, where he touched. Who did Holgado touch? I don't believe I wrote that down, Rich. Do you
Let
remember?
me check back through my notes. What did you think about that penalty, though? I mean, I think that's the more pertinent point.
Oh, I thought it was weak. I mean, there was a gap. If I remember, it's like there was a gap. He went for it. I think you should be allowed to go for the gap. I don't think he could have seen the riders on the outside. And as everybody's trying to go to one racing line, I would have deemed it racing incident. That, or I would have, I mean, I could kind of maybe see a long lap penalty considering we've condensed the race, right? The double long lap would have been fine if we were going the whole distance of the 20, 17, 18 laps that we go up Mugello. I would have said, okay, fine. I could maybe see it. Given the circumstances, I would have said one, but irregardless, it doesn't really matter, right?
It must be said that the usually jovial and very mild-mannered Hervé Poncharal, who of course is boss of that squad, put out a very, very angry press release afterwards. I mean, he was spitting about, well, about the penalty in the first place, but particularly the fact that it was a double long lap penalty. And I personally felt that that was a unbelievably harsh penalty for a, relatively forgivable mistake on the first corner of a restarted race. I mean, I thought they were meant to give people a little bit of leeway given how chaotic the starts of races are. So under the circumstances, I just thought that was a very poor call by the stewards.
Yeah, I again, I a poor call, exacerbated by applying the double long lap where I think everybody would have had a slightly calmer reaction to it if it had been a single long lap.
Yeah, I
But
mean, he did make a mistake and he touched another rider and that
agreed.
rider went down. So, I mean, that is penalty territory. And a long lap, yeah, I agree. You'd have said, well, maybe still a bit harsh given it's the first corner, but a double long lap? I mean, a double long lap to me, it kind of insinuates that there was sort of malice or stupidity involved. And I just don't think that's an allegation that can be made on the first corner of a restarted race when everybody's adrenaline is just through the roof. So, yeah, anyway, we won't dwell, but I just thought that was a stupid decision. Not the first one of the weekend either, but anyway.
True. Vire has really come on. He's got a lead over Alonso, Munoz, Ortola, Furusato, and Yamanaka. Now, these front six are gone. It's going to be decided amongst these six or whatever. You have Alonso sort of in the prime position here, but Alonso puts his head down at, with about three to go, and he starts to open up a gap. Like he had about a half of a second lead on the guys. With two to go, Alonso's actually got 7 tenths of a lead. Which was like, wow. And it was like, okay. Then we got to the very last lap, and Ortola, who was running third at the time, goes down at turn 12. Argument as to whether maybe he was helped by Vire, but he really wasn't. He just sort of lost it on his own. The first replay kind of made me think that Vire may have been in a bit of a problem because I was expecting a penalty, given what happened at the start of the race. Let's just have one at the end of the race just to make everyone really mad. Cooler heads prevailed and nothing was done there. But Alonso would win. Vire would be second. Yamanaka would be third because of Ortola's crash. Then Furusato, Munoz, Ortola then remounts to finish sixth. A great ride by Alonso. This kid is every bit the star that I think we thought he was last year. And he's now won in a different way. He managed a tire and then said, I'm going to pull the pin and go, and you guys can't come with me. Fine. So he's winning races and he's winning them differently. He's not a one-trick pony. It's I can do it on the last lap from about third or fourth. I can save tires and then just pull away at the end if I need to. Or I could, we haven't seen him dominate a race and lead from start to finish, although I think Jerez would have been that race and he would have won in that style. But we haven't seen it yet. But the kid's good. Vire is also very good. The Dutchman, very good as well. I mean, I think those two are destined to Moto2 rides next year
Yeah,
easily
100%.
for that. And then, again, we'll figure out. But it's interesting, Hogardo, I don't have the championship standings here with me, Rich. If you could help me run those down,
I
I
can.
know that if you could run those down for us, it'd be great. And we'll talk about where we are on the points.
Yeah, okay, so Alonso obviously is in the lead on 143 points. Then you've got Danny Holgado on 106, so he's 37 back already, and already dropping into that kind of run of form where bad luck, bad calls, other people's accidents that involve him are starting to dent his title aspiration. So anyway, he's still second. Vaya is in third, 95 points, so he's 48 points back, so it's quite a big gap. Then you've got Ortola on 80, so he's 63 behind. And then in fifth in the championship is Munoz on 60 points. So he's a full 83 back. So he's not in contention. I mean, for me, I would say at this stage, it's Alonso and Vire are going to be fighting this one out. As you just said, Jim, I think possibly Holgado will kind of steadily drop back. He seems to be on that run of form again. Alonso, people are already sort of talking about his name with Acosta as a comparison. I mean, he is super, super cool, isn't he? And let's not forget, I think you mentioned in the fact that he just got his head down in qualifying and just didn't let Ortola being behind him bother him at all. And he set his pole lap on the very last lap. So he went across the line just, checkered flag came out, got one last go at it and set the pole time. I mean, that is a cool head on young shoulders there. So it does very much feel a bit like an Acosta level talent at this point in time, excepting that, he's got to win the championship and then he's got to see what he does in Moto 2. And Vaya shouldn't work on a Moto 3 bike. I did ask him about this in Qatar last year, if people refer back to the interview, but he was absolutely dead set. No, his size is not an impedance to him. And it certainly doesn't appear to be, does it? But I can't think of many riders with his stature that have done as well in Moto 3, because it doesn't seem to be a tall guy's formula to me. But he makes it work for sure. But again, he has to go up to Moto 2. Given the Moto 2 riders in the Liqui Moly, certainly Darren Binder, I think, is probably on a sticky wicket. So there might be a slot opening up there for him. But anyway, sorry, I'm going on.
No, that's okay. I think you're correct. I think Vire is is going to the local Molly Husqvarna team in Moto2. I think that's where he's destined. I think that Alonso is going to Tech 3, GasGas. I think you got to put Alonso there next year, let him have a year to acclimate to the bike, which would be 25. I think 26, he probably runs rampant in the class and wins a title, a la Acosta. And I think you see him slot into GasGas, on the MotoGP team in 27. That's just the projection I see. I will be wrong, I guarantee you, but he's a talent.
I like that kind of progression, though. That makes a whole heck of sense to me, particularly the bit where he jumps on a MotoGP bike without the encumbrance of having been on the outgoing
Yep, you
type.
don't want to taint him. In my opinion, you don't want to taint him with a MotoGP bike. Hey, look, learn to craft here. Even if you did magically win the world title in Moto2 your first year, who cares? Stay there, develop it, and then come in and get a MotoGP bike, because then you give him like a 1 year deal on the GasGas. And if you want to, make him teammate to Acosta, because those two, oof, you're gonna have some crazy going on there. Anyhow, that was Moto3. A really good race. It was a good race.
Yeah, it was.
You know,
It was entertaining. Yeah.
entertaining race. So we'll go to Moto2, which I'm going to tell you straight up, folks, this is the best race of the weekend for many reasons, but not the reasons you think. Yes,
Come on,
part of that
Jim.
is, but part of it is, I'm not going to lie, but I thought it was the best race on merit because there was a fair amount of passing and there was a fair amount of back and forth. But let's talk about qualifying really quickly in Moto2. Basically, Jacobo, Binder, Ramirez, and Van de Gerberg get out of the first session and get to the second session. Now, on and we learned that Audeger was not going to go out. He had a neck, sore neck, that it was one of those things that no one understood why he had it, what was happening. It was very, very stiff. He was trying to get a massage. They went to the doctor that was there. It didn't seem to help him at all. There was definitely something going on. What's that one where your neck hurts? It's like, is it meningitis or something? I can't,
Yeah,
I'm not
could
the, I
be.
should have asked my wife. I think,
Yeah,
but I
she's the
thought, like,
medical expert. Yeah,
yeah,
no.
I forgot to ask her. That's my fault. I was packing to get here in Rhode Island, folks, so I forgot to ask my wife. But I think it's like meningitis out there. Ooh, maybe he's got that, because that could be a potential problem. But he wasn't going out and qualifying, so he was going to start 18th at best. Halfway through, Garcia has the fastest lap, followed by Gonzalez, Lopez, Pessini, the wild card, Chantra, and Kennett. Roberts is down in eighth. Literally, we get down to the very end of this, and it's like you're waiting for something to happen, and basically it's Roberts. He jumps up to the pole with a 130 lap. I mean, his best lap before that was like a 149.8. Then he jumps up to a 130, which is like just amazing that this big jump that had taken place. It was like a track record lap, I think, for him to be able to do it. Actually, I think the record was like 149, I think, was what he set.
Yeah, again, they've been going like 1.5, 2 seconds quicker a lap on the Pirellis,
Yeah.
haven't they? It's just mentally much faster. Incredible.
Garcia would be second on the front row with him. Lopez, Gonzalez, Binder, who from that first session, so Binder having a small run of form, and then Ramirez was there as well. So that was how the Moto2 race was going to start, with those guys going there. It was the first pole position I can think of that Joel has had. Maybe he had one more. I can't remember. No, he's on pole somewhere like Qatar or something.
Yeah, I think you're right, because he's a bit of a Qatar specialist, isn't he? Yeah.
Bit of that, yeah. But either way, the race was cut to 12 laps because of the red flag that happened in the Moto3 race just before it. So we're down to 12 laps, and I'm thinking at the beginning of this, I'm like, well, it's 12 laps, it's a sprint. We're not going to have to worry about trying to save the tire. If the tire is going to make the distance, we can just run this one flat out. Like the last time we had sort of one of these shortened races, Roberts wins. So I'm thinking there's a possibility here. Let's not get overexcited, but we have the possibility. Roberts got off to a whole shot, followed by Lopez. Binder was right there with him. Audeger was 18th off the line because that's where he started. Agüero was like sixth. Then, Lopez then got by Roberts. And I'm like, okay, that's not really good. Then you had, Binder there, Kennett, Garcia. Then Audeger was down at turn four. So Audeger comes off the bike at turn four. Not sure if any of that.
He was taken out by Alcoba,
Right. Akoba takes him out.
who got a penalty after the race, which he'll have to serve next time out.
That's what we need to talk about. Was it basically Alcoba just literally cleaned him out?
Was it shown on the TV? I don't recall seeing a replay of it, Jim.
There's a quick one on the Dorna feed. It did show Alcoba just basically clearing in, you know, in way too deep, lost the front, just cleaned him out. Because I was wondering if he was going to make it with the pain, right? I mean, if you had that kind of pain in your neck, and that's a, you know, high speed, the arrow over your head, your helmet, it's really going to move your head around. It's going to make it hard on you. And the worst thing is, if you get that pain, other things happen in your head, right? You can, it's like an eye thing, twitches, stuff like that happens when you get to that level of pain. So I was concerned whether Alderger was actually going to make it, but then he didn't have to because, you know, Garakova cleans him out. Now, they did, after the race, they did give him a penalty. I think that one was the justified one of all the penalties. I agree with that one, that he's going to have to have, was it position, grid position, start penalty, or long
Oh,
laps? I don't remember what
I
it
can't
said.
recall what it was. I just remember seeing that he had been given the penalty post-race,
Yeah,
but
it's weird that some people get penalties for long laps and some get grid positions. Just, again, this is consistency about stewarding that we really don't want to talk about right now
yeah.
as we go. Let's just say that they're doing the best that they can. Roberts was on the wrong side of one of the curbs. He's kind of like Alonso, that same section of curbing there towards the end of the lap. Gonzalez would get up to second. Bender goes down at turn eight. It's still Lopez, Gonzalez, and Roberts. Canet, Garcia, and Agura. Then Roberts got by going into turn one. I'm like, okay, this is really good. But Lopez came right back by Roberts. And then it's like, okay, wait a minute, hold on here. Roberts fought back again. So we have this exchange of lead here three times within like a lap, lap and a half, which is really some pretty good racing. And they're really going at it. Then Gonzalez is at the front because I think what the Roberts and Lopez touch at turn one, that causes them to run wide. That allows Gonzalez, Canet, Lopez, and everybody sort of to run underneath of them. And I'm like, well, okay, that's it. Put the flag back in the drawer because we're done here. We're not gonna, you know, we're in a mental disaster here that, you know, we're just, well, we're gonna maybe get a penalty, maybe get a podium. But I was looking at it from the standpoint of like, well, that's better than what usually happens because at least Garcia is behind us. And for, I don't know why, but Garcia could not make things happen. He had a second place starting position. He was always sixth. He really had no pace to catch anyone. So I'm really concerned with what was wrong with Garcia. Like, I don't know if he got a, I don't want to say anything bad about Pirelli, but did he get a bum tire? Did he spin a weight? Did it slip on the rim? There's all these little things that could have happened. Did he just pick wrong? But I think everybody was on SC1s. They were on the softs. I mean, it was 12 laps. But if Garcia was betting on going with like a medium rear or the harder SC, I don't know what the harder Pirelli compound is, but if he was running on the harder compound and that's what he was wanting to go the whole distance and the bike was set slightly differently, maybe that tire didn't work for him during that time frame. But then with 3 laps to go, or sorry, with four to go, Kennett's still leading, but Roberts now gets by Lopez. So Roberts fights back. He's down and forth. He fights back. He has like, well, here we are on the podium. What's going to happen with Garcia? Well, Garcia isn't going anywhere. But then Roberts, with three to go, takes the lead going into one. And it's like, okay, all right, good. That's really good. We're still leading with two to go, but Gonzalez is pretty much all over Roberts as they head into one, but he defends it off as well. And then Roberts and Gonzalez kind of, for some reason, check out. Like, I didn't see it, but I had the suspicion that Lopez, like, had an out of the seat moment or a twitch or something that caused Canet and him and Agura to sort of back off for that little second that allowed them to go. I didn't see any of it on camera, but there was suddenly a gap
Yeah,
between
there was.
Roberts and Gonzalez before the third place guys. So I was like, okay, it's going to be settled between these two. And I'm thinking, all right, let's get the flag back out. I opened the drawer again at this point. Still not prepared to really take it out, but the drawer's open. And then Roberts is going into turn one on the last lap, and Gonzalez goes by. And I'm like, oh, crap. This is not, you know, no, please don't. Please. No. But bam, straight away back into turn two. Roberts takes it back, baby. And Roberts then goes on to win the Moto2 race. Then Gonzalez, Lopez, Garcia would finish fourth. Then Anshu and Canet, because like Canet had a off track or had run on wide on the curbs, and that let everybody get by him to get there. I think Garcia kind of made an aggressive move and kind of pushed them off the way and allowed Agura to come through with him. That was a great race. in the Moto2 race. It was great. It was fabulous to see Joe win a race. I think you can argue this is a shortened Moto2 race. If it went the full distance, had Joe, would Joe be still at the front? I don't know. But he is the leading Kalex on Pirellis, for sure. He's in the hunt. He's drug himself back into the fight because he needed a victory. After what had happened prior, he needed a victory. He needed to put something together to get back on the podium and win. And he needs to honestly string a couple wins together to keep Garcia at bay. Because what is the points gap right now? I know Garcia is still leading the points, but Joe has cut it down.
Yeah, so Garcia on 122, followed by Roberts on 115. So Joe's seven behind. So very close. Then you've got Agüero, who's been sort of stealthily racking up the points as kind of is the Agüero way. But he's on 99, so he's 23 back in third place. Then Alonso Lopez on 79 points, so he's 43 back, which is starting to look like a pretty big gap. And then in fifth, you've got Manu Gonzalez on 66 points, so he's 56 behind. So, you know, Roberts, by a country mile, the best Kalex performer out there. And actually suffering a little bit, I think unjustly, from the fact that he's surrounded in the races and in the championship by Bosque-Skuras, which is a bit of an unfair comparison, given how good the Bosque-Skura and the Pirelli combination is with the riders that they've got this year. So, Joe, as I say, you've got to put Manu Gonzalez in there because he's having a terrific year as well, it must be said. But Joe is, yeah, having a stellar year. And I think I WhatsApp you, Jim, didn't I, a little bit later on Sunday, once you'd had a chance to see the race, to say this is not the Joe Roberts that we've been accustomed to seeing. The elbows out kind of Joe Roberts has suddenly emerged. I'd be curious to know how and why. He's always been quite a... I mean, he is, having spoken to him again in Qatar, he's a very sort of mellow, gentle, very sort of typical kind of West Coast American guy. You can see him out on the beach on his board. You know, he's very sort of chill.
Yeah, he's a laid-back Californian.
He really is. And, you know, that was kind of the way he was riding in the seasons that I can recall. But this Joe, the one that fights back Bayless style, we haven't really seen that Joe Roberts up until now. And if he's going to carry on like that, then he is going to be in the title fight all year, whether they're shortened races or longer. I personally think he would have run the race irrespective of the race length. But he was at it, and fair play to him.
Yep, fair play the whole way around with Joe. Again, I don't know where this aggressive Joe has come from. I really don't know. I don't know what has turned on. Hopkins had a little interview with the Dorna feed where they said, hey, look, we got to focus on today and today only. Today is about qualifying. Let's go and do the best we can at qualifying. Now let's go do what we can in the race. Let's focus on today, not tomorrow, not next week. And, you know, if your name is being floated to go to an American team in MotoGP, that's going to really mess you up, I think. I don't care how chill you are. I don't care how stone cold killer you are. That's got to play with your mind slightly.
Oh, it must.
Because, I mean, I look at it, that's the dream, right? The dream is a MotoGP ride. I don't think any racer would care which team it was. Hey, I made it to the dance. I'm at the ball. The question is, how long am I going to stay at the ball?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that that's got to take a little focus off what you're doing. And I think Hopper has wound Joe back in and said, look, if you want this, you have got to get it together, focus on the now, worry about the now, and do what you got to do. Again, this is a track Joe Roberts really likes. Let's see what happens when we go to the Netherlands, to the Assen, to the TT, right? In 3 weeks. So, yeah, it was a great to see. Great to have an American doing well. This is good for Liberty. This is good for MotoGP. Again, you want to grow the population in the United States and make them come to MotoGP. This is kind of how you're going to have to do it. Yeah. Hey, watch the young up and coming, you know, the Joe Roberts and, you know, whoever else we can, you know, Alonso, right? Acosta. Those are the things you want to sell. And if you can sell this title fight and you have an American there. Now, Was it motivation that Trackhouse says, yeah, well, we're not here just to put an American on the bike? I think Justin has to say that because I think a lot of people just think this is the guy just spending money and he doesn't really necessarily care. I think him being there at the track in Mugello shows he does care because he could have been in Texas and he wasn't. He was with his NASCAR team. Fair play. But to go to Mugello and be there, yeah, the guy's a racer and I think he wants to make his team the best team that he can possibly make. And I think he's going to make those decisions based on the talent and who he thinks is going to fit into that team. And if Joe fits, then Joe will have a ride. If Joe doesn't fit, Joe doesn't have a ride. I think it's that clear and cut.
Well, yeah, I mean the interview that I referred to earlier on that he gave, what he was effectively saying is that the sport, and particularly this sport, is a meritocracy, or it should be at least. And on the basis of Joe's performance on Sunday, provided he can continue to do those sorts of performances, not every race, because that's not necessarily fully realistic, but if it's a meritocracy, then he earns the ride, if there is a ride for him to go to. And obviously, we don't know precisely what Trackhouse's position will be. But can I just say a couple of things about Joe just before we move on to MotoGP, Jim? I was particularly pleased that he won it in the style that he did, because yes, it was a shortened race. And I think a lot of people might sort of slightly uncharitably count that Portimão win as borderline lucky, given how many riders crashed at the turn one or two in that rain shower that came down, which decimated the field. Now, Joe, in fairness to him, he went on and won the race with whoever was left, to take part in the second start. But a lot of the main contenders were not in that second race. So this was a proper win, even though it was a shortened race. But this one, there's no doubt about it. He won that fair and square, and he really got his elbows out in order to do it, just to make the point even firmer. So I think that's one thing. And the other point about the distraction of the Aprilia ride, I think, is a double distraction for him, because of course he had an Aprilia ride dangled in front of him a few seasons ago, and he chose, well, either he chose not to take it, which I believe is what happened, or the opportunity went away. And I think I've mentioned this on the pod before, and it's long enough now that I won't be sort of betraying any confidences or causing any trouble. But I was specifically asked when I've interviewed him in Qatar last year not to mention the Aprilia deal that fell through for whatever reason. So that clearly has played on his mind. And the fact that there's another one opening up is just going to ramp that pressure up even more. I just find it sort of, in a very good way, sort of ironic, in a jovial way, that of all the people to have in his corner to calm him down, it's John Hopkins, a man who was famously erratic and all over the place in his sort of main MotoGP career. Great guy. I mean, he's impossible not to like John Hopkins, but, well, he is for me anyway. But yeah, given his background, I mean, for him to be this sort of guru calming everything down, I just find that hilarious, really, in a very sort of positive, jovial way. I mean, I'm not having a go at the guy at all, because he's clearly helping Joe a lot. And don't forget as well, Robert's taking that ride with Ramirez coming in alongside him. It was quite controversial when that broke last year, because of course it booted Rory Skinner and Sean Din Kelly at the team at the time, and that was not a popular decision. So there's a certain amount of vindication in all of this for American racing as well, which I won't comment on that because people will have their own view as to what went on. But it's good for American racing anyway. Let's leave it at that.
Yep. All right. With that, let's go to MotoGP. Try to finish this up here real quick. The first qualifying session in MotoGP, you had Didier Bender, Miller, Bezzecchi, Quartararo, and Augusto Fernandez, the only KTM or KTM clone motorcycle in the second qualifying session. Automatically, Pedro Acosta.
Ouch.
Ooh, yeah, that hurts, right? Basically, Morbidelli and Augusto Fernandez get out of their pole, who was wild carding, had a very nasty little crash there. He kind of like lost the back, then the front, then the back of the front, and kind of got thrown to the ground viciously. Luckily, pole was able to walk away from that one. We get into that second qualifying session, and Acosta and Marquez almost come together because they're dawdling along the racetrack. And I don't know who is really to blame, but Acosta did just miss Marquez. As they were waiting to see who was going to, be there. But wow, that was, You had an incident like that that goes absolutely untouched by the stewards, which I think is ridiculous.
Yeah. Marquez was lucky to get away with that. Yeah, very lucky.
I mean, oh, he is sort of the villain of the group, though, right? I mean, he kind of he kind of plays that role, and he plays it quite well. He's the villain to Acosta's superhero. You know what I'm saying? It's just sort of that's how it works out. And then you sort of have these bit players like, Pecco, who shows up occasionally to steal some limelight, and is essentially, for lack of a better definition, the Robin to the Batman that is Acosta, right?
He's
The lead.
pretty under the radar, Banyard, isn't he? I mean, this is a double world champion, reigning world champion that we're talking about, it must be said. But he goes about things in a fairly, for the most part, a fairly calm manner, I would say, unlike many of the others that you're talking about.
Benaiah was out by himself. He worked his way out. He pulled a stunner. He pulled out, got the bike started, got on, threw a leg over it, kind of clutched it forward a little bit, then quit. Everybody ran out of the pits to go with him, right? Then he was able to get his own little gap as he went back into the pits. He was by himself. He did not get to the pole in the first session, but it was very close, but it was not there. Marquez would crash in turn 11, which hurt his chances of starting. But in the end, Martin would be on pole. Then you had Vinaya, who was second, but he was going to receive a 3 grid place penalty only in the race for blocking Alex Marquez and where the penalty loop is on the track. Total BS. This one was a well-played theatrical show by one Alex Marquez. It reminds me of the footballer who falls over and rolls around holding his knee and draws the card, right, Rich? That one, that's what it reminded me of.
It was a bit of handbags at dawn. Yeah, it was all a bit of a storm in a teacup, really, wasn't it?
Yes.
Thank God we don't have rider to pits radio like they have in Formula One. Can you imagine all the moaning and
Oh,
groaning that would be
yeah.
going on? Horrendous.
Yeah. So Bagnaia would be second in the sprint, but he would start fifth in the race. Vinales, then Marquez, then Bastianini, and then Morbidelli. So we went to the sprint race. Bagnaia got off with a great start, followed by Bastianini, who had another great start, followed by Martin, then Binder, then Marquez, then Vinales. Acosta's starting like seventh, I think, on the grid and was there. Oliveira and Quartararo both crashed. There was no further action taken for that incident there. Bastianini got by Martin at one. Him and Martin touch as they continue on. One goes underneath the other, and well, there's no further action that was taken on that little incident as well, which I don't know. What'd you think of that one, Rich?
Sorry, are you talking about Oliveira Quartararo or?
Oliveira Quartararo, sorry. Yes. There
Well,
was no action taken. What'd you think?
a staggering decision. I mean, okay, this happened on the Saturday, not the Sunday, but we were talking about Holgado on a first lap, taking somebody out, making a mistake, and taking Oliveira. That's precisely what happened. He went, dove up the inside of Quartararo, touched him, and they both went down. Quartararo went to see the race stewards afterwards to get an explanation and apparently came out more confused than when he went in, which is code for saying that they just refused to give him any meaningful decision or, rationale for the decision whatsoever. I just don't understand it, other than the fact that both riders went down. But nothing against Miguel Oliveira. I mean, he is one of the cleanest, tidiest riders out there by and large. And he's been on the wrong end of this sort of thing more times than he's given it out. But as far as I saw the incident, he just pulled off a move and it didn't work out and he took both of them out. So, yeah, extraordinary not to get a penalty for that of any kind.
I have no understanding of the rules anymore. I mean, again, we were doing so good, and now we seem to swung the pendulum back the other way to, I don't know. I do not understand. I mean, the only thing I can think of is that they wanted to send a message because of the fact that it is Mugello. We have very high speed going into the first turn. Perhaps they're trying to set a message that, look, guys, you've got to be more polite, careful, something. Don't do it by giving weird penalties. Just literally tell them in the riders' meeting, hey, cool your jets in the first turn. I don't know. Anyway,
Yeah.
we'll never get done if we keep ranting about stewarding. So
Just so
it was bad.
inconsistent and hard to understand. And again, the major gripe that comes out on this always, Jim, is that the stewards never give any clear reasons for the decisions that they've made or the decisions that they haven't made, perhaps in this case, more to the point. So anyway, yeah, just odd, but moving on.
As the front pack starts to get away, Acosta sees the idea. He's got to get the hurry up. He again forces his way past Binder. Martin and Mark Marquez are now battling each other. Banyaya is pulling away from all of this, but Acosta's starting to catch everybody. Marquez would get by Martin at one. With five to go in the sprint, Banyaya, Marquez, Martin, Acosta, Morbidelli with a really good ride here, and Binder. Four to go. Martin crashes at turn one. Wow, I did not see that coming. I mean, Martin was starting to hunt people down, but that's like the first time he's not scored points in any sprint race, which is an impressive statistic.
Yes, but he was off cover all weekend, and again, you do wonder whether everything else going on behind the scenes perhaps just got to him a little bit. I wasn't particularly surprised to see him go out because, yeah, he was just a bit off color all weekend. So, yeah, odd, but perhaps not completely. Now we know what we know, everything that was going on across the Friday, Saturday, Sunday, perhaps not so hard to understand in some respects.
I agree with you. In the moment, I was like, wow, Martin made a mistake. I don't really see that from him.
Unusual in a sprint race, yeah.
Yes. And he is the sprint master. He does make some mistakes. I think we're all human. We all do make mistakes. I just didn't expect him to make one here, especially given and knowing how many points you have ahead of your closest rival who is up the road on you, and you're kind of really not being forced to go faster by anybody behind you. An error, nevertheless. But Benyawad goes on to win the sprint. Marquez will finish second. Acosta gets another podium with the KTM. I mean, consistency of this kid, especially coming from behind in sprint races, is pretty amazing. Morbidelli with an outstanding ride to be fourth, followed by Vinales, who just showed up at the end of the race, and then Binder as well. So, is there anything there from the sprint you would like to add, Rich?
No,
Yeah, there's
for
not
me,
much
the
going
main
on.
talking point really was Martin going down and then the Oliveira Quartararo thing, which we talked about. So not a scintillating race, really.
No, it was not the best sprint race. We go to the MotoGP race on the following day, on the Sunday. The question was sort of tires. We sort of had everybody going to the grid on a medium front, a soft rear. However, Michelin was saying, like, look, the performance of the medium rear is almost equivalent to the soft rear, but it's going to last a little longer. So there was some question as who was going to switch, if anybody was going to switch or whatever. Vinales did go with a medium rear to start the race. I was like, interesting choice. I thought maybe Marquez would have gone. I think Marquez came to the grid on a medium, but changed it to a soft when he got there, because there was some, classic Marquez trickery, if you will. That seems to be the forte of what that man does. But either way, Martin got a whole shot. Then Yaya, of course, now who was fifth this time, charges into the corner and winds up leading as they come out. Fantastic start by Benya, who really hasn't had very many golden starts, if you will, does get a good one this time. From there, Marquez was in fourth. Few laps in, Marquez, he's got attacked by Bastianini out of turn one, but Acosta goes by there, but Marquez goes back by. So again, we sort of have the greatest rider of the era, Marquez, by championship, and the rookie just battling each other all the time. They seem to be intertwined with each other. There's a lot of smoke coming off of Mark Marquez's bike when he comes out of the final corner. There's a black strip that happens and smoke happens, and it's like, whoa, what the heck happened there? At first, I thought maybe it was an oil leak, something getting on one of the exhausts. And I'm like, oh no, man, let's not have another bike problem with Gresini. That would just be way too brutal. It apparently was or is part of the ride height system. They're allowed to have a specific, very low ride height on the rear for the launch at the start. But during the race, there's a limit to how far they can drop the bike. Apparently, there's obviously like some sort of a cam or the different, yeah, best way to guess is a cam that is used to drop the ride height down that prevents it from going any farther. Apparently, that was either touching part of the tire and creating smoke and rubbing, or as it was coming down, there was some other facet in there that was now moving against the tire. The black mark on the track is the part that I can't really figure out where that was coming from, but it was obviously something that had to do with the ride height because it continued throughout the race. And even Alex's bike showed exhibited a few occasions of that particular ride height device causing smoke. So it was interesting. I was just hoping that we weren't going to rub enough rubber off of this to create a leak or a blowout, which At the speeds that Magella would have been really bad. Rich, you seem like you want to have a word here.
Well, at the risk of sort of being a bit sneaky, as you say, the fact that Alex Marquez's bike was doing as well made you think, are Gresini pushing it a little bit in terms of the bike just to try and make up? Because we know that that bike isn't getting off the turns like the 24 Ducati is. So are they playing a little bit fast and loose with, I don't know if it's a regulation. I mean, given how much smoke was coming off Mark Marquez's bike, and as you just said, the worry about blowouts on the front straight at Mugello, because when they happen, that is not a good situation. Anybody remembers back to Shinya Nakano on the Kawasaki years back, losing a rear tire on the front straight in Mugello. That was a monster crash. So I was a little bit, not fearful, surprised, perhaps would be the word, that he didn't get the black flag with the orange circle in it. You know, they come into the pitch, you've got a technical issue with your bike because of the safety aspects of that. Because I wonder whether the black line on the track was almost like molten rubber, given how fast the wheel's spinning up at that, you know, coming off that final turn, which is a fast turn anyway. And if they're spinning as well, maybe it was just, yeah, dropping some of the rubber on the track as it was kind of taking it off the shoulder of the tire. Don't know. It looked dangerous to me. I'm surprised he didn't get the meatball flag.
I did think it sort of like lessened as the race went on. And so to the point, I'm wondering, there is a bit of a dip there as you dip down and back up. I'm wondering if Mark was actuating the system earlier than what he had been in an attempt to lower the bike to gain the traction out of there. And it just a combination of lowering and the G-force compression of going into that small dip, or at least going up the hill. I mean, you're running straight and then into that hill is going to put a compression into the suspension that it might have been just enough to rub, right? If he had done it 2 seconds later, maybe it wasn't rubbing, because I didn't really notice it towards the end of the race. It was really like for a 3 or 4 lap gain there, somewhere between, you know, laps 16 to lap with 10 to go. Those 6 laps, that sort of 4 laps that sort of ran around, 6 laps, I mean, that ran around in there. I don't know.
And we know Mark is very aggressive with the way he engages the ride height, don't we, as well? We saw that earlier in the year. So, yeah, it could be.
Anything's possible. Speculativeness from us here. But Bagnaia is out in front. Martin's right there. Bastianini, Acosta, not Marquez, Acosta, and Morbidelli. Mark gets by the Bastianini for third with 6 laps to go. Bagnaia is ahead of Martin and Marquez and Bastianini and Acosta and then Morbidelli. And then basically with 3 to go, Martin is just closing in to Bagnaia. Like, well, we're finally going to get something because we've been through a relatively little dry portion of the race. It was follow the leader. Nothing really seems to be really happening by all that. We got Bastianini now all over Marc Marquez. But with 2 to go, Bastianini puts a move on him, on Marc Marquez. And Bastianini is now into third. Bagnaia is now pulling away again after he had sort of sat there for a couple laps, responded to what Martin was doing. And Bagnaia simply rode home on the Ducati to win. Bastianini was by Martin on the last corner, which was the only really highlight of the race, was that fact that, you know, Bastianini got by Bas Martin. Then Marc Marquez, Acosta, and Morbidelli. A great sixth for Morbidelli. Acosta, I think, in the points and chasing the best rider of the era, I think, which is fair to say. Marc Marquez home after that. And then, you know, I think the Ducatis are fast in a straight line. The 25 is always, the Ducati always is. The two best bikes were there. Again, three factory Ducatis essentially rounding out the podium there. And a Gresini Ducati in fourth and a KTM. Interestingly, I thought that Acosta's bike was not quite the rocket that it was in Catalunya. I don't know what happened. I don't know if it's like an acceleration thing that makes the KTM seem faster, or but they're both fairly fast sweeping turns leading onto a long straight. So I would have thought the speed would have been equal. But for some reason, Acosta's bike wasn't as fast in a straight line as it was in Catalonia, in my opinion.
Because Binder set the fastest speed trap time of the weekend.
In a tow with a bunch of other bikes, because he did that.
Okay.
He was mid-pack when he did that.
Right. I mean, maybe it's just an aero thing, perhaps.
It could be.
Yeah. Who knows? I mean, I know they can't change there because that's a homologated fairing. They only get a couple of shots of that, I think, under the current rules, don't they? But yeah, don't know, Jim. That's a bit odd because, yeah, as you say, the bike was very, very, very quick in the Barcelona main straight, but and a little bit less at Mugello, but who knows? Acosta's is making the most of what he's got, though, isn't he? I mean, with that, there's no
Oh, yeah.
doubt. But it was,
But no
I mean,
doubt.
in my notes, I just wrote boring race. I mean, outside of lap one with Bagnaia going from fifth to first, which was a mighty first couple of turns by him. I mean, that won him the race, really, because he could just boss it out front from that point. And he is obviously pretty untouchable in the last few years at Mugello, Bagnaia. But first lap, last lap, in terms of the Bastianini pass on Martin, rest of it in the middle was, fall asleep, boring, really, wasn't it? Let's be honest.
Yeah, it was a boring
Just not
race.
a classic. But you can't, they can't all be classics, and that's why you remember the classics, because they come along a little bit less frequently. So, you have to put up with these from time to time.
With that, I believe Martin still leads in the points, although Bagnaia did take a healthy chunk out.
He really did, actually. So, because I wrote this down. So, coming out of Barcelona, Bagnaia was 39 behind Martin. He's now 18 behind Martin. So, he's taken a big chunk of points back. So, Martin leads on 171. Bagnaia on 153, as I say, 18 points behind. Then you've got Marquez strongly in third, 136. So he's 35 points behind Martin at the minute. But bearing in mind how inferior his bike is, I mean, that will have had Ducati's attention for sure. Then you've got, I can't read my own writing here, is that Bastianini? 114 on 57 behind. And then Acosta's back into fifth place. I think he uses it Vinales. Over the Mugello weekend in the points table. So Acosta on 101. He's a full 70 points behind now. So, I mean, he's a long way back, but he's already job done this year because he's shown what he can do and he's got a works contract for next year. So most people are surprised that KTM are not moving Acosta in place of Miller, or wonder if they might mid-year this year. Because a lot of people are thinking Miller's not going to improve on that bike and best to give Acosta half a season with the new crew, although he probably would bring his crew chief with him and maybe one or two others, but in, the full work setup, different personnel, different operations, give him half a season to get used to it and then go for the title next year.
Maybe. Last thing I gotta say, the Ducati factory bikes looked brilliant in Italian racing blue.
They did look very nice. Yeah, I will agree. And normally it's a bit of a curse and a kiss of death if you put a special livery on a bike, isn't it? So to
Yeah.
come home 1-2, that was quite some vindication for them.
Oh, that's all I've got, Rich, for this episode.
Yeah, just literally, this will take me 60 seconds because we've got the
No, no,
TT
go ahead.
going on at the moment on the Isle of Man. We're not obviously not there, unfortunately. I'd love to go maybe next year, but we haven't got any interviews or anything like that to report. But have you seen? I must mention this. Have you seen the Davy Todd onboard footage on YouTube?
No, I have not.
I'll send you the link. People look it up, or perhaps try and put the link in the show notes. It's a helmet cam. So it's not kind of like the static camera behind the screen or down on one of the forks or whatever, which we're used to seeing. I mean, they're very spectacular, those views, but this thing is just lodged just in the aperture of his visor. And bloody hell, it is absolutely terrifying. Honestly, you have to kind of look to say, hang on a minute, I've got this on, speeded up 1.5, 2 times speed, because you just can't fathom what they're doing. I mean, I can't fathom why they're doing it, to be honest with you, because as much as I like bike racing, that is just another, that is way off into the distance of what I consider to be normal behavior. But it is very spectacular. So we'll try and give some notes to find that YouTube clip. Peter Hickman won the Superbike race on Saturday. Michael Dunlop won the Super Sport race to get to 26 wins, which equaled Joey Dunlop, his uncle, which was obviously a huge deal. Today, Michael Dunlop has won the Super Twins race, so he's now on 27, which I think makes him the winningest rider
That is correct.
of
I
all
read that
time, doesn't
today.
it?
He is the winningest rider on the island.
Yeah.
It's fitting that it's done that a Dunlop beat a Dunlop.
Yeah, absolutely. And quite likely to add another race win, or possibly even two this week, because he went out of the, no, I can't remember which race it was. I'm guessing it was the Superbike race, because his visor came apart from his crash helmet, so he had to stop and reattach it, which cost him kind of 50 seconds. So it's been a bit of an action-packed week, and so there's Thursday and Friday to go. I don't know if they race on Saturday or because it's the Superbike race is the final race of the week. So there's at least 2 to 3 races to go. So we'll perhaps try and talk about it a little bit more. But so far, so in terms of everything I've read and seen, everybody's safe and sound over on the island, which is great news. Devastated to see somebody stolen a classic set of leathers from John McGuinness's motorhome. So hopefully the culprit of that will be found and thrown in prison as soon as possible, because we don't really like to see that sort of thing going on at motorbike racing events. So yeah, check out the TT and particularly go and find the Davy Todd, TODD, onboard footage, because it is something to behold. And I think that's everything from us, Jim.
Yep, everybody ride safe.
Cheers, everyone. See you next time.